Welcome to Mike Linus. I'm Will Sloan here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
Look, the way things are in the world, I don't want to make mountains out of molehills. I want to give everything its proper moral weight. So as we launch into some light news, I just want to make clear, this doesn't matter. But we all need to have some fun, okay? And I think this is maybe some fun news that we can all just have a little bit of fun with. So there's only one filmmaker nowadays, and his name is Martin Scorsese. Over the past few years, you know, him being the sort of guardian of cinema's soul, you know, railing against the comic book movies, the man who's the champion for cinema as art, he's become a real lightning rod, particularly for those in what we'll call the comic book community, the comic book movie community. Uh-huh. I don't want to disrespect.
Hashtag not all comic books.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the folks who like Robert Crumb are totally excluded from this. And, you know, whenever he has a new movie out, as he does now, you might have heard, interviewers will inevitably kind of broach this subject. They know that this is kind of, you know, this is the stuff that clicks are made of. And Scorsese will always repeat his position. You know, we need to support the real cinema, that sort of thing. And it's always funny that the people who make the Marvel movies, you know, consistently rise to the bait. They're always very upset by it.
Yeah, I mean, can I interject to ask you, I mean, is the Scorsese Marvel discourse, I mean, to what extent do you think that it's like an organic discourse? Because at this point, it feels a little almost like reverse engineered for me. Like it's a meme, but maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there's something kind of more authentically at stake in it.
It's a chicken and egg thing. If it didn't get clicks, there wouldn't be the clickbait about it. But then also the clickbait fuels it. And there's a whole, I mean, we've talked before about how the internet is just bad and getting worse. You know, there's a whole clickbait economy.
I mean, myself in this debate, I have a kind of a third position. I'm a neither Washington nor Moscow here because I'm more of a Christopher Nolan guy, as you know.
Well, every now and then, you know, Martin Scorsese's daughter, Francesca, will do like a funny viral video with him where she's like getting him to do slang or she's, you know, making him wear a backwards ball cap and do a rap. Or, you know, whatever they do in those videos, you know, classic old man does slang comedy.
Right.
And we all love it. It's all fun.
It is funny. It's Martin Scorsese, it's great, for God's
it's
sake.
It's the greatest filmmaker of all time having fun with his daughter. And who doesn't like that? And there was a recent video where it's him, you know, he's speaking to the camera and he's saying,
"So I have, you know, I've been working a long time making pictures, it turns out, almost 50 years. Had one muse for many, many years, 10 pictures made with Robert De Niro. Another muse, Leo DiCaprio, was extraordinary. Had 6 films with him so far. Over the years, I've worked with great actors from Ellen Burstyn to Paul Newman, Michelle Pfeiffer to Margot Robbie, all these people. And I feel now that I need a change. I need to find something that I could take further."
And he's saying all that to a dog. And that, you know, that's the funny thing. And Joe Russo, who is one of the Russo brothers, and you don't know who they are, but you certainly know their work. They made Avengers Endgame. They made Avengers Infinity War.
Ah, those Russo brothers.
But they've also done a one for me, a movie called The Gray Man on Netflix. Which is one of those movies that...
Oh, yeah, I think I've scrolled past that a number of times in the past week.
The algorithm would tell us that 11 billion people have watched it. Uh-huh. That's what the official...
Who's in The Gray Man? What is this?
I don't know. I refuse to know who's in The Gray Man.
This is like one of those movies, like what was that one with Gal Gadot and like The Rock?
Red Notice.
Right, where you scroll by that and it's like, okay, this is not a real movie. Like
They specialize in not real movies. And Joe Russo did a little poking fun of Instagram video where he like edited himself into the Scorsese video where he's holding his own dog and he calls his dog is named Box Office as if to imply that, you know, unlike Scorsese, you know, he gets the box office. And there's an article in Variety today, Avengers director Joe Russo touts box office over Oscars in playful jab at Martin Scorsese. Film community sounds off. Quote, rich asshole hack, unquote. And the article is just this collection of tweets and statements and comments of people saying, for example, here's one. Joe Russo took hundreds of millions from Netflix to make whatever he wanted and came up with The Gray Man. Marty got hundreds of millions from Netflix and Apple and made The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon. Another film writer writes, in 50 years, no one will know who Joe Russo is. Another tweet. I guess The Gray Man is no longer the most embarrassing thing directed by Joe Russo. And Joe Russo, you know, whatever. Everyone's got to have a job.
That's a very you got to hand it to him style move there.
But when you're a film director and to do the not mad, actually laughing, my stuff makes more money than yours at the box office thing with, you know, Papa Scorsese. Like, you have to know on some level. Like, you can heap all the scorn that you want on Joe Russo, but he knows. He wouldn't even bother replying to Scorsese. What he imagines, it's not like Scorsese named him specifically, but he took it personally because he knows that he's betrayed his profession. He's betrayed his craft and his spiritual fathers. You know, Martin Scorsese, key to his origin story is one of his early movies, I think his second feature-length film was Boxcar Bertha, which he made for Roger Corman. It's an exploitation film, kind of a Bonnie and Clyde style movie, cashing in on that. And he showed it to John Cassavetes. And John Cassavetes said, Marty, you wasted a year of your life making a piece of shit. It's good for what it is, but surely you have something more personal you want to do. And he went and he made Mean Streets. And in Joe Russo's, you know, cold, dead eyes, you know, you see somebody who would hear John Cassavetes say that and would lash out and then not make Mean Streets. Mind you, Joe Russo probably doesn't have Mean Streets in him.
Yeah, that I was going to say.
Again, a little fun item and important to keep in its proper proportion because there's so much pain and suffering in the world.
Well, I mean, look, as far as discourses go, I do think one of the reasons why this kind of thing keeps, you know, coming back, even though it is like a meme and it is, I mean, as you said, it's a chicken and the egg thing, but it is partly clickbait. I mean, I think to answer my own question from earlier, I mean, what's at stake in this is really this is just the same meta debate that's been litigated and relitigated in popular discourse for the past quarter century or so. This is the poptimism debate. That's what it is, right? And I think of that essay that I think was published in Slate some years ago. It was called Against Subtlety, which, you know, basically argued that, like, you know, subtlety and kind of layers and that sort of thing, you know, that's actually an overvalued trait. Like, art is better when it's like direct and, I don't know, didactic, and when it has a message and it states it bluntly. And the thing is, there's no one formula, right, to successful or good art.
Certainly a Woody Guthrie song states what it means.
That's right. I mean, there is art that's good precisely because or in spite of or however you want, you know, because it's direct or because it only has sort of one level that, you know, gives it, you know, and that by extension gives it a quality of authenticity or an organic quality or something. And by the same token, you can have films or books that are so kind of multi-layered, so bogged down by theory and other kinds of, you know, conceptual baggage, so overly intellectualized that they don't really work and they don't really convey anything, even if it's kind of ambiguous. But I do think if I have a side in this debate, you know, I'm not on the side of the people who argue in a sort of whole cloth way that, oh no, most good art is incredibly direct. Stories should have kind of a single layer, you know, by extension, you know, the characters should be virtuous, their actions should be virtuous, so there should be some like moral at the end that's good. And, you know, related to that, as kind of came through in what you were saying earlier, something's good if it does good at the box office, because that means it's populist. If something is more narrow in its appeal, that's actually bad. It's actually elitist if you like that. And, you know, it's from on that basis that you get all those kind of tiresome memes about, like, did you see that thing recently that was like, God, I can't remember which publication put this out, but it was like, TikTokers are striking back against the scourge of the lit bro or something. And it's like,
oh, thank God, finally.
The lit, right. I mean, it's like the lit bro, what is this, like 2011? It's like, this is just a meme at this point. Like, most people have never met the lit bro.
David Foster Wallace, it's cannot be more dead than he is right now.
Yeah. Do you remember when they tried to assimilate, like somebody tried to assimilate like a bunch of other authors into that same canon, and one of them was Goethe? And it's like, ladies, if you walk into his apartment and you see the Sorrows of the Young Werther on his shelf, you know, get the hell out of there. I mean, come on, like, what the hell is this? At a certain point, this is A, incoherent, and, you know, because, yeah, like the lit bro or whatever other caricature we're talking about here is just a meme at this point. Obviously, we can imagine people that conformed that stereotype, but like most of us have never actually met the lit bro except as a meme or an antagonist in a listicle somewhere. So it's incoherent, but I mean, it's also just on some level anti-intellectual and anti-art, because yes, there is art that's direct and doesn't have many layers to peel back and is effective for that reason. But if you preclude art that's complicated or challenging, you try to create some heuristic, some metric by which the more layers something has, the more more tension, the more contradictory points of view are expressed in it, whatever, the worse it is, the more pretentious it is.
What I told you, it's classist to have ambiguity in art, because people who...
Yes, I've heard this one before.
People who are struggling every day just to put food on the table and pay their rent don't have time for ambiguity.
Man, I have literally come across that argument in the wild. Yeah, that's the anti-ambiguity, bro, right there. But no, seriously, I've come across that where the argument is, depth and sophistication is classist because what? What's the implication? Because what working class people are too dumb to like deal with sophistication. They're too illiterate and uneducated. They're too driven by their baser instincts and tastes.
Well, that's why we can't.
That's the implication of it.
That's why theaters simply should not be showing Joker. Because it will incite a bunch of Bernie bros to riot. I do think there is some truth to the fact that too much ambiguity can render a work incoherent. Like I was just watching Ernest in the Army, and it's like, where does this movie actually stand on the American Imperial Project?
Question of militarism.
Yeah. It's like Ernest is like a willing pawn in this. Like all of America's intervention in the Middle East, Ernest just goes with it, and like. What are we as a viewer to take from that? It's like, is he our surrogate? Are we supposed to be like willing subjects like Ernest?
God, and when you think about it, it's like putting Ernest in all those wacky situations, but you know, wacky situations that are adjacent to militarism. I mean, doesn't that in many ways sort of defang and neutralize the violence at the core of any imperial project? And in that sense, it serves the empire.
That's so true.
You know, I mean, I'm glad this has come up today because I've had a bone to pick with you for a long time about like your constant glorification of the Three Stooges, who I just think, you know, there's so much glorification of violence in the Three Stooges, and like you're able to look past that because you look at everything through like 15 layers of irony.
Well, again, I think you're just showing your class position here, because a lot of people, I mean, you would prefer it if like Curly and Moe solved their disputes through rhetoric. But for ordinary people who are just trying to make it through the day, the emotional labor required to do that, like at a certain point, like violence like is a tool. Like it's interesting that it's always the oppressor who's telling you not to use violence as a tool, right? Like have you ever heard, like how many times have you heard nonviolence from the oppressed actually overthrowing the system? Like I don't see it. And I think that really shows kind of what your biases are.
I've said it before, I stand by it. Mo and Curly should have resolved their differences by having like a Socratic symposium. They should have sat at a table like, you know, enlightened diplomats putting an end to a lengthy and destructive conflict. No more of this violence.
You must stay at home. You should not be meeting friends. If your friends ask you to meet, you should say no.
Shall I get the karaoke machine?
Ooh.
The death toll climbs every day.
So leaving dues.
Christmas quiz.
Birthday.
Bring your own booze.
Is there anything we don't have a party for?
What happens at number 10? Stays at number 10.
No comment.
All right, everyone. Well, we do have a movie for this week, or in this case, a TV drama. This is a British one. It's called Partygate. It aired on Channel 4, courtesy of Channel 4 Films, on October the 3rd of this year. It is, of course, a fictionalized version of the eponymous political scandal dubbed Partygate, which, of course, led to, you know, represented kind of the beginning of the end of Boris Johnson and was probably the most high-profile case in the world among many of political leaders and, you know, people in working at the upper echelons of government who, you know, broke the very rules that they were setting, strict rules around lockdowns and protocols and that sort of thing. I have to say, in praise of this, I mean, I didn't expect it to be bad. I expected, you know, like similar things we've watched in the past along these lines, you know, in Britain especially, places like Channel 4 have for decades, I think, made a whole genre out of these sort of dramatic reenactments of, you know, political events. I think of that one we did about Clegmania and like the 2010 British election, whose name now escapes me, which again, not bad, very sort of workmanlike effort. I followed that election very closely and I thought, oh, this is, I remember when this happened. I remember this line in the debate, etc.
As well as all those Peter Morgan dramas, like the Tony Blair ones, which I feel like it's much more common in Britain to have these kind of like ripped from the headlines drama films than it really is in the United States.
I guess in the States, you know, I think of things like American Crime Story, where, you know, the most recent one was the Clinton Gate, the Clinton affair.
I mean, what's interesting about those and...
Or the OJ, the OJ one they did.
There's the Pam and Tommy show that was a year or two ago. And a lot of those have a kind of like the impetus is revisionist history in some way. It's like taking big scandals from the 90s and looking at them through a sort of modern progressive lens.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Pam and Tommy was fundamentally about revisiting those events. And it's, you know, pretty much explicit argument, rightly, was that, you know, the world was very unfair to Pamela Anderson. But I think you're right that there is a difference between how the United States, you know, culturally approaches this sort of thing and how Britain does. I mean, in Britain, these quite factually specific, plucked from the news, as you put it, dramas that are, you know, based on real events, often the very recent past. I do think Britain has a higher kind of propensity for creating these. And I have to say, I mean, I did actually enjoy this more than I was expecting. I thought it was quite well done. It does drag a little bit at the end, maybe for the last 15 or 20 minutes, because when you, you know, when you've seen one or two of these parties, you've kind of seen all of them. But it still comes in at a trim, you know, 85 or so minutes. So it's pretty efficient. And I mean, the reason why it drags on a little bit at the end is just because it's so determined to cleave to the actual events themselves and the timeline. And it uses kind of as a frequent device, you know, news footage, actual press conferences given by Boris Johnson, you know, the famous leaked footage of Allegra Stratton, you know, the former Guardian journalist whose podcast I used to listen to a lot in 2009, 2010, the Guardian Weekly podcast, who became Boris Johnson's press secretary. I mean, that incredibly damaging footage of the sort of rehearsal press conference she did where she was just laughing about the COVID protocols and the parties and things like that. And then her, you know, her tearful resignation a day or two after that leaked.
I've just seen reports on Twitter that there was a Downing Street Christmas party on Friday night. Do you recognize those reports?
I went home. hold on.
Would the Prime Minister condone having a Christmas party?
What's the answer?
I don't know. I didn't
want the party. It was cheese and wine.
Just be clear, it's not.
So is cheese and wine all right?
No.
It was a business meeting.
I'm joking.
This is recorded. This fictional party was a business meeting. And it was not socially distanced.
There's a lot of real footage like that. There's also a lot of real footage from people's social media, just of empty streets, you know, people's Instagram and TikTok.
I would say it kind of comes like 60 to 70% of the way to doing something interesting with the style. You know what I mean? Like there are some Adam McKay-ish flourishes here or there where somebody will like look at the camera and say, they're showing me DJing here, but it's not confirmed if I actually, my real self DJed and I denied it in real life.
I really liked that because it was kind of like the people who made this dupe building a legal disclaimer into the script where it's like, okay, look, we know that this particular special advisor to Boris, we all know that she was DJing the parties. That's why people were referring to her as the DJ. But was that in the Daily Mirror? Well, no, but look, we all know that she did it.
Like this movie is like just good enough that I wish it were just a little bit better.
Yeah, no, I feel you on that. But I think just again, in praise of it, given how workmanlike this type of effort usually is, I thought it was very well done. So let's go through the plot a little bit. Our kind of audience surrogate character is a woman named Grace Greenwood. And we should say that most of the characters you see on screen are sort of composite characters. You know, most of the sort of mid-level special advisors and things are fictionalized or composite characters, though there are real people alluded to as well. And we frequently see the back of Boris Johnson's head. There is an actor who plays Johnson and does, I would say, a pretty good Boris Johnson impression. But Grace Greenwood is sort of the audience surrogate character. And what we learn about her at the start is that she's from a red wall seat. So she's from somewhere in the north. So she's a bit of a fish out of water. She, for some reason, finds Boris Johnson very inspiring. She's extremely excited when she gets a job in the Brexit unit at Downing Street. So, you know, the unit in number 10 Downing Street, which is charged with actually figuring out how to make Brexit work. But, you know, for obvious reasons, she's a little bit of a fish out of water in the Downing Street setting. There's a very good scene, I guess, at the very first party where, you know, the parties, incidentally, I think are filmed very, very well. They're filmed exactly like like one remembers a really like boozy night after, often like one where maybe you got really drunk, but you didn't actually have that much fun. You know, the kind of thing where you might have gotten drunk with your work colleagues, which is exactly what these people are doing. And so as, you know, the party's carrying on and people are getting drunker and drunker, one of Grace's colleagues is sort of introducing her to every person in the room, just being like, oh, that's so-and-so. Yeah, he went to Oxford. Oh, yeah, PPE on this one. You know, of course, like half of them went to Eton. Basically, it sets up Downing Street, you know, as it really is. All these people who come from like the three or four different like Soviets farm teams from which the Tory party sources like 99% of its staffers. There's a really funny scene at this party where she is, you know, I guess like one of the boys is trying to chat her up and he's sort of saying like, oh, your granddad was a steel worker. He sounds absolute legend, you know, whatever. And he works, I guess, in the Downing Street unit for leveling up, which was, of course, this like really stupid bogus concept, one of these like faux populist concepts that was the bread and butter of Johnsonism, where, you know, he's basically talking about what they want to do to the north, and it's like, you know, yeah, turn it into, you know, we're gonna make Yorkshire into Silicon Valley or whatever. So the movie gets, you know, the pieces on the board with these opening scenes, and then basically what follows is a sort of just, you know, factual retelling of the events, and we see the parties themselves become more and more debauched and debased.
The movie has this main drama as it's through line, and interspersed throughout are talking head interviews, I think most of them documentary, of people who were charged and fined enormous sums of money, often under rather dubious circumstances, for COVID protocol violations. One guy who was charged £10,000 for instigating a snowball fight in the park or something like that that violated social distancing. There's like documentary footage of police breaking up a COVID gathering that's, you know, three or four people in a room.
Yeah, there's an awful one where it's like a socially distanced funeral. I mean, this kind of thing. I mean, I have to say, I mean, this looks insane in retrospect. It's a socially distanced funeral where there's like six people sitting in a room. The priest starts giving the eulogy, or, you know, the two people who are grieving like push the chairs together. They're all masked. And then like some official steps in from off camera and he's like, no, you can't move the chairs. It like breaks them up.
As well as many cases of people talking about loved ones who died, you know, giving their final farewells to their mother or their grandmother through Zoom.
Yeah, then meanwhile, it cuts to like, oh yes, on this exact night, Boris Johnson is speaking to his like drunken staff and he's just openly joking like, ah, this must be the most unsocially distanced party in the UK. Many bits of the script and, you know, key lines are taken right out of the Sue Gray report, which was, of course, the big investigation into this that was sort of the end to Boris Johnson.
And in fact, the filmmakers will often put text on the screen citing the exact source for particular lines.
Something else I really like about the narrative is how little time the characters actually spend doing any work. And it's important because so much of the quasi-defense that was offered of this behavior, and in fact, right at the beginning, there's a clip from LBC where it's like some irate caller, some Tory voter somewhere who's defending the behavior. And basically their argument is like, look, you know, these people are running the country, like they should be allowed to do this. They were working really hard.
Then it cuts to people at the NHS in hazmat suits,
right?
You know, dealing with 1,000 deaths a day.
That's right. And there's one key meeting where you see them kind of like gesturing at some actual work, and it's right ahead of the date when Britain is going to leave the EU, and they're discussing the Irish border question, and it's clear like they have absolutely no idea what they're going to do. And then one of the people in the meeting, this guy, just starts chiming in. This is the leveling up guy, I believe. He starts chiming in and he's like not interested in the Irish border question. He's like, look, can we have Big Ben like do a big bong like right at midnight? And like various people are exasperated, like, okay, but we have to talk about this Irish border question because in 13 days we're leaving the EU and we don't know what's going to happen with the Irish border. And I thought this was a really nice touch. He leaves the room and he's just like, well, the boss cares about Big Ben. And this is a really important comment on Brexit, I think, and what the true meaning of Brexit to these people, you know, to the type of person who would want to go work for Boris Johnson at number 10 Downing Street to work on Brexit. There was so little interest, it seems, in the actual mechanics of how this was going to work. Like the political potency of Brexit came down to a fantasy that, you know, just on such and such a day at, you know, when Big Ben struck midnight, you know, these wondrous new vistas were going to open up. Like the NHS was going to be better funded. Everything was just going to work better. And then what Brexit actually came down to, I mean, as far as I can tell, the most kind of visible changes have been things like, the passport is like a different color now. And they didn't even change the currency because Britain never adopted the euro. I mean, ridiculous.
There's this mass of like middle managers and kind of white mediocrities. You know, all the sorts of people that you, the listener, and I at many times in my life have worked alongside. You know what I'm talking about. Us and our little email jobs.
Look, I've had one of these jobs. I've been a political staffer I've done different political staffing jobs, but I can tell you the least important ones I've done.
They're all great people.
I can tell you a job I had doing comms once. I mean, yeah, your job is you go in and you send emails all day. And I think I've talked about this in the past.
And like, then you go home and you watch your little Netflix show and you wait to die.
Well, I speak for yourself. I went home and I read Tony Benn's diaries. Thank you very much. But no, what I think I've talked about it in the past on Mike.
Did you people hear that? Can I murder this man right now?
I don't think this isn't, you know, betraying confidences or anything. But when I used to work at Queen's Park, I mean, one of the things that struck me was like the banality of much of the work I did versus like the pomp of going into work. Few know this. Here's a secret. It's not really a secret, but actually probably few do know it. At Queen's Park subway station in Toronto, there is a special entrance into the legislature underground, this like heated walkway where you walk past art.
Wow, like Batman. Do you put your eyes in an eye detector?
Like you have to have a scanned like key card, and then you come out of like the subway, which is, you know, let's just say a bit of a juxtaposition. This like it's the winter time, the subway station is cold, it's dirty because, you know, people have tracked, you know, all the dirty snow in there and stuff, the mud from outside. You go through this heated walkway and it's just the most like, you know, it's just this lavish like corridor, everything around you, this like 19th century splendor. The legislature itself, when you get there, is actually like in need of some repair. But there's a lot of stuff, particularly in the buildings around it and in these like rather exclusive corridors that you can walk if you're a staffer there, where, yeah, it's designed to make you feel important. There's just like an aura to the architecture that seems very deliberate. And the fact is, like, a lot of the people who are working there, they do feel it's important. You know, lots of people are, of course, more sensible about it. But like, yeah, I remember, you know, one of the rituals was sometimes after work, there would be these like, yeah, again, these kind of like boozy, like socials or whatever, often put on by some like lobby or other. It would be like, oh yeah, the Craft Beer Association, they're having like a do. And you go there and it's like, oh, there's the Tory staffers and there's the Liberal staffer, there's the minister for this and that or whatever.
And let me guess, there's a little photo booth where they have like little wacky masks and little wacky hats and like a hula thing that you can put around your neck and you all pose for silly photos because you're weird.
Yeah, right. Man, yeah, I hated these things. I mean, you go like the first week, you know, you're like, wow, it's just there's like an open bar at these things. This is like free wine. And then I don't know, by like the third night you've come home and you're like, okay, what am I going to do? Drink like four glasses of wine every day after work? And there's something like that radiated from those events where I just kind of was like, I don't like this. And it's like, if the public hates politics, it's because of stuff like this. I don't really want anything to do with this. But yeah, and the whole time hanging over your head is the fact that, okay, look, there's a lot of pomp around this. I send emails, okay? That's what I do. And yeah, this Partygate movie does a really good job of conveying the fact that, yeah, what is this hard work that people are doing all day? Well, yeah, NHS staff are wearing like what you have to wear to venture inside of like a nuclear reactor core. They're having to wear that every day. But yeah, these people are working so hard that they deserve to enjoy like wine time Fridays. They're sending emails.
And also through our black cleaning staff.
They have to clean up after all these parties. It's disgusting.
As well as elderly security guards who are janitors. Treated with, at best, contempt, at worst, you know, contempt.
Yeah, I mean, this was apparently a real thing in the Gray Report, was there were security guards who basically came in and tried to put an end to these parties or say, you need to go outside.
And they say, excuse me, Gov, there's a class system in this country.
I mean, like, that is pretty much what happens in, like, the scene where this is depicted in the movie. But I have no trouble believing. I mean, that's exactly how a certain kind of privately educated person who goes to work for a Tory prime minister, that's exactly how they look upon like the help. And, you know, this is a bit of a generalization, but I actually do think this is a genuine cultural difference between Britain and the United States. You know, both the ruling classes of these countries, of course, are utterly deluded and self-interested. But I think in the United States, because of the revolutionary Republican ideals of the, you know, 18th century, because of the stories America tells about itself, and because it is just a newer society that doesn't have like an ancient landed gentry in the same way, I feel like the American ruling class really deludes itself into believing that, no, on some level, we're all fundamentally, you know, equal or something, which isn't to say that members of that class aren't, you know, just as rude to people they consider inferior.
It's not built into the national myth in the way that it is in Britain.
Well, I just think that it's more possible and it's less kind of politically toxic to express like open class chauvinism if you're a member of the British elite. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Partygate thing did take quite a while to actually bring Boris Johnson down. You know, I think this is actually worthy of wider comment here because, you know, we were talking earlier about how Britain seems to produce lots and lots of films like this, these dramatizations of real events that in many cases, and certainly in this one, are absolutely scathing, just completely contemptuous about the ruling class in a way that, frankly, I would not associate with the American equivalent of these things.
And yet the BBC and institutions like it are also at times extraordinarily deferential.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the contradictory things or the core tensions about, you know, the British character, to be, again, somewhat general about it, that I find endlessly fascinating. You know, I think here actually of some polling after one of the debates that Jeremy Corbyn had with Boris Johnson, where basically Corbyn won among the audience that was polled in every single category that was like, understands issues that affect people like me and my family, cares about people like me. And then there was one category where Johnson won in a walk, and it was prime ministerial. And doesn't that just say it all? Now, I want to read actually from something, probably the best analysis of Partygate that I've come across by the great British writer Richard Seymour, who I interviewed. You know, you can listen to an interview I did with Richard about the British establishment's reaction to the withdrawal from Afghanistan. You can find that on our Patreon. But Richard on his Patreon, which, you know, there's only a handful of writers that I subscribe to, but he's definitely one of them. You know, everything he writes is worth reading. This is a piece called Death and Enjoyment from January 21st, 2022. Richard writes, "The reason the Johnson administration is in trouble is not because it had a number of piss-ups. It's because it couldn't democratize the hedonism. The politics of pleasure is essential to the new right. Johnson's appeal, though nationalized, greatest place on earth, quote unquote, was built on a specific type of capitalist hedonism. He could, quote, bring us sunshine because he was seen as a fellow who had a good time. Farage, that's Nigel Farage from UKIP, plays a similar game. He's reputed to be a ladies' man who likes long, boozy lunches, enjoys a smoke, and isn't too politically correct to laugh at a racist gag. There is, of course, a generational aspect to this. Boomer journalists who moved to the right, I'm thinking of Burchell, Cohen, and Hitchens. I don't know who Burchell is, but that's Nick Cohen and Christopher Hitchens, obviously. Love their naughty flaunting of booze and fags, cigarettes, that is. Nonetheless, it goes way beyond this. Trump was fond of Epstein parties, leering at his own daughter and grabbing pussies. Bolsonaro, building his base on evangelicals, the military, and ranchers, tends to find his pleasures more in the transgressive joy of killing, rape jokes, and racism. Climate denialism is frequently predicated on the idea of leftist killjoys sucking the fun out of life with their war on lethal cars. Look at it the other way. If the new reactionaries are fundamentally motivated by authoritarianism, why are they so often libertarian? If they were principally driven by the ideology of protection and security, why did they not jump on the chance to protect and secure once COVID-19 struck? Johnson's administration was consistently determined to evade social restrictions until the last minute. Trump initially prevaricated on the issue of lockdowns before coming out as a freedom fighter. Skipping ahead a little bit, we can ascribe some of this to a social Darwinist ethic in which the weak are killed off by what only makes the rugged stronger. Plenty of evidence for that in right-wing leaders' strongman responses to infection. But social Darwinism just ontologizes the breathless, creative, destructive excitement of capitalism. As Bolsonaro put it early in the pandemic, I'm sorry, some people will die. They will die. That's life. You can't stop a car factory because of traffic deaths. When he says that's life, he's accepting that the enjoyment of life means accepting death, impurity, and tragedy, and nonetheless gleefully embracing the enjoyment of creative destruction. And this wouldn't appeal to millions of people who have everything to lose from it if it didn't contain a participatory appeal. You can also enjoy. That's what right-wing freedom politics amounts to. To reiterate what I said before, had Johnson been able in some way to democratize the hedonism that was enjoyed in the gardens of Downing Street, it would have not provoked this malicious egalitarianism, that's a quote from Adorno, this resentment from Tory voters against an elite hoarding all the fun. And that's why right of Tory parties have far more of a chance of galvanizing them, even if the left avoids being conscripted into the centrist politics of pearl clutching, which can so easily be turned against the poor in the interest of exploiting Tory chaos. So I think that is a really key point that Richard makes there. And it's something that's very easy to miss in the whole Partygate thing. It's very easy to read the situation. And, you know, it's not entirely incorrect, but it's very easy to read the situation as purely, a matter of political hypocrisy, right? These people were setting the rules. They weren't following them. And that's something the film captures very, very well. But I think Richard's reading is ultimately the one that, I think that is the most insightful reading of Partygate and its fallout. The real problem wasn't that Johnson was doing this stuff and that his staff were doing this stuff and his advisors were doing this stuff. The problem is that they weren't able to give it any kind of like populist garnish. They weren't able to translate it into any kind of politics, no matter how superficial, of enjoyment that in some ways, to use Richard's turn of phrase, democratized the hedonism. And I think that's the real reason why Partygate ended up being so devastating for Boris Johnson. That, and then I think, the fact that, when the film depicts this as well, when Brexit happened, there was supposed to be a lot of fanfare and essentially like, what actually changed? Was there a land of milk and honey at the other end of the rainbow, to mix my metaphors? I don't think so.
Hey, Bill, I'm here in New York. This is where I live, across from the welfare office. Meet Joe, the doorman.
16 years I've been working at this address, and for 16 years people are walking by this building with a white piece of paper in their hand looking perplexed, and they come up freely and they say, I'm looking for the welfare office, or I'm looking for social services, or I'm looking for food stamps. I see that most of them are able-bodied. They don't look like they're handicapped in any way. They just look like they don't want to work, and it's really, really hard to look at this and say, I come to work every day, why can't you?
I'm here trying to get some Obama bucks. That's what I'm doing, trying to get some Obama money.
I ain't here to get some benefits. You know what I mean? I'm here to get a check. Bitch, I want a check.
Tell me why you like Obama.
Because he gives me stuff.
Who are you going to vote for in this election?
Obama.
Why?
Because he's black.
So what do you get from the government? Tell me everything you get from the government.
All I get, stamps, public assistance. Medicaid. We call it money in the bomb.
All right, what you just heard was a clip of a segment produced by Alexandra Pelosi in a 2012 episode of Real Time with Bill Maher. She was a former contributor to that show, now a frequent guest. She would do a little segments kind of like TV Nation or that sort of thing. little kind of irreverent takes on the news of the day. And that was her haranguing people outside a welfare office that had the temerity to be across the street from her building where she lived with a doorman.
Man, that's the second time I've seen that. I missed that detail the first time, that like it's autobiographical. Like one of the reasons she's so offended by this is not just that a welfare office exists, it's that it's in her neighborhood.
We see her talk to her doorman who's like, hey, these people, they're coming up here with their, coming up to our door, our sanctuary, all the time trying to find the welfare office. And hey, I can work, why can't they work?
God, these little specks of dirt on this pristine edifice of bourgeois decadence here in central Manhattan. God, I hate to be reminded of the wretched of the earth coming to get their Obama bucks.
And, all I can think of is earlier last week when Joe Biden was, when Joe Biden was denying the death toll in Gaza. And here's the daughter of Nancy Pelosi, saying, not in my backyard. It's like, this is your opposition, folks. This is your liberal opposition. These are the people. And Reverend Wright was correct. God damn America.
The politics of this short, which, she and Bill Maher are just watching to be like, hey, wasn't that funny? Get a load of these people. I mean, this is like Nixonism.
You'll notice in all of her films, Alexandra Pelosi is only comfortable. The only time when she has like any juice at all when she's debating these people is when she's trying to outflank them from the right. Like consistently. Yeah.
But I have a family.
I have a family. I believe in family values. I believe in family values more than Republicans do. Like whenever she's arguing with people about like the wall, and she says, but don't you think the wall is racist? And her opponent says like, well, no, it's not racist. It's about protecting our borders. She never has a follow-up because she can't argue from the left of anyone.
Yeah, but she can argue from the right, which she's definitely doing in her queries to these various welfare recipients.
Oh man, it's great to find that little forgotten piece of Alexandra Pelosi lore and share it with you folks.
Yeah, can you believe that this guy who has some kind of a criminal record, probably because he stole like a piece of juicy fruit once, can you believe that he's collecting welfare instead of going to like one of like three different jobs that won't hire him. Can you believe that these other people who aren't even disabled, you know, will come and get a check for $250 a month and collect food stamps instead of going to work in a Burger King kitchen for $6.50 an hour?
Okay, you know, another one of the moves
they
that
could be doing meaningful work like that.
Another one of the moves that like Democrats will make is, isn't it so strange that the working class are constantly voting against their own interests? But when she asks all these people in line, who are you voting for? They all say, Obama, he's giving me money. He's right. giving me free stuff. And sounds like these people are voting for their interests.
Right, which don't forget, is the whole right-wing argument. It's like, the problem is that these people vote for their own interests, which means they will vote for free stuff, which is why we have to end democracy. Popular democracy is bad because popular democracy equals free stuff. And free stuff is bad because life should be a martial struggle for survival. It should be socially Darwinian. Except for people like me.
Yeah. So you got one party who's saying that, and then another party who is also saying that.
You know, tying actually this conversation and, you know, the theme of COVID together, a moment from the pandemic that I think I will never forget to the end of my days. Courtesy of the Washington Post, Jeff Stein, I was going through, you know, he brought my attention to this, the r/unemployment subreddit, when there were kind of, you know, this brief period where there was both the unemployment checks and the relief checks going out. And there were all these people saying, I literally haven't been able to stop working. I haven't had more than 2 days off in a row for 20 years. And now I finally quit my nail biting habit. I learned to play the guitar. I finally had enough mental space to, you know what? I don't want to go back to my job. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to go study something I've always wanted to study. I've been reading books for the first, whatever. Like, people just, because of having $1,000, $2,000 a month, were actually able to enjoy their lives instead of, you know, working in, you know, degrading, you know, alienating workplaces or whatever.
Well, thank Christ they put an end to that.
Right. Well, exactly. And this is what I'm coming to. So the moment that I've never forgotten is when Steny Hoyer, Democratic House leader, you know, one of the top ranking Democrats, when the debate was happening in Congress over whether they should kill the unemployment checks, Steny Hoyer, he's being interviewed on, I think, CNN. And he just says straight up, look, I mean, we talked to employers, you know, we heard from the Chamber of Commerce, and they said that, you know, these checks are making it harder for them to find employees. So, you know, that's why we got to kill the checks. And that moment has stuck with me for a number of reasons. But I mean, among them, I mean, just further to what you were saying, Will, about like, this is your opposition. This isn't something that Steny Hoyer was saying in like some closed congressional leadership meeting or something. This isn't something that he and Mitch McConnell, when they're having their clandestine discussions in a posh office somewhere about like how much money to take from poor people's pockets this week. This isn't something he's saying there. This is one of the top ranking leaders in what is officially the like reformist, progressive minded opposition. I think Donald Trump was still president at this point. And the public facing spin he's giving this on like this extremely unpopular measure, we're just taking money from you, that has allowed literally millions of people to enjoy life like never before. And he's just saying, oh yeah, no, like we heard from the Chamber of Commerce and they say like the liberation of the serfs is making it harder for them to till the fields. So the serfs have got to go back to the estates. That is something I will never forget. And I don't know, I feel like Alexandra Pelosi really captured more with this mini film of hers than she intended to. By the way, is there more to this? Was this just a segment or was this like a 25-minute movie or something?
No, this was just, you know, a little amuse-bouche on the Bill Maher show.
Well, and this is a little amuse-bouche, I suppose, at the end of the meal for all of you. Just a little Alexandra Pelosi chaser, little dessert at the end to go with your vegetables this week. Hope to see some of you in Vancouver this week. I'll be at the Central Library on Wednesday, November the 1st. Thanks again to everyone who came out in Ottawa and Toronto. I will also be in Windsor later in November. Hope to see some of you there. Maybe some of you from Detroit as well. But for now, signing off, I'm Luke Savage. And as always,
watch this drive.
And only let's say to Africa, it's Christmas time. Because we've given all your cash to all our friends. In governmental support, like the act that didn't work.